being able to take that wild Georgia oyster and turn it into something that could be served at a fancy restaurant as a half-shell oyster is a really, it's an artisan thing. It's more than just hard work and blood, sweat, and tears and getting muddy, but it's also, there's some art and craft to it that we're really proud of too.
In Georgia's lakes, rivers, and tributaries, a growing industry is staging a takeover. It's not trout or rice or sugarcane. Nope. Today we visit a farming couple on the cutting edge of Georgia's oyster renaissance. I came from the mud, there's dirt on my hands. Strong like a tree, there's roots where I stand. I'm David Zelsky, and this is the Fork in the Road podcast, presented by Georgia Grown and the fine folks at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Each episode, we feature stories from Georgia's farmers, fishermen, merchants, artisans, chefs, and others who help provide Georgia-grown products to folks in the Peach State and beyond. On this episode, we're hitting the water, specifically the Bull River in Savannah, where an oyster farming couple hope to bring new life to an old industry.
On the logo, we're going to be coming down the Bull River. Down to the Wausau Sound, and that right there is where the farm is.
That's Perry Solomon, the experienced aviator turned oyster farmer who runs Tybee Oyster Company with his wife, Laura. You've got to love this to do it right, and it's obvious to me that Laura and Perry Solomon love what they do. Perry's passion for oysters goes all the way back to his formative years.
I grew up on Tybee Island, getting oysters, going out and doing recreational harvest of oysters with my family has always been something that is a bit of a family tradition. I grew up doing it with my granddad and with my dad, just for church oyster roasts and getting family and friends together and stuff like that. But it's also really special to me because I can't eat shrimp or crabs. I'm allergic to crustaceans. And growing up, this was the one thing that I could participate in harvesting and being a part of. It kind of became my thing, and I really like oysters, so.
I really like oysters. I love that. And oysters don't just taste good. They're an important part of our whole aquatic ecosystem.
So much like bees, they're considered a keystone species. They provide significant benefits to their ecosystems. Not only do they clean the water, an adult oyster is commonly sighted with still drinking 50 gallons of water a day. When they are attached to the shorelines, they help protect from erosion. So there's a lot of benefits that they provide. To the environment, you know, we're optimistic that by educating and involving people at a young age, they can start to learn about how important that is.
Laura and Perry share impressive resumes with deep education in engineering. And in this line of work, that knowledge actually comes in pretty handy. Though these days he spends a lot of time in the water, much of Perry's career has been in the sky. He's a captain with Gulfstream Aerospace and former U.S. Navy aviator. And I want to apologize in the show. I said he flew an F-14 and he did not. And he's fine with it, but he's been getting crap from all his friends.
Oh.
He's like, I'm cool with it. I didn't fly F-14s. Like, oh, it was like 15 or one of the other jets. But I guess in aviation, that's a big deal. I'm like, sorry, I can change it. He's like, no. I love it. Don't worry about it. His time spent traveling the world with the military opened his eyes to a burgeoning industry with deep connections to his Tybee Island roots.
As we moved around the world with the Navy and saw oyster farming becoming a growing industry, we kept coming back to the same question of like, well, why aren't they doing it in Georgia? Because I'm particularly partial to the taste of Georgia oysters, obviously. And we have one of the most beautiful estuaries anywhere in the world with this salt marsh that goes tens of miles deep up and down our coast. It provides the food and the flavor for these oysters that make them really special. So
Laura and Perry are actually the first in Georgia to use the floating basket system of oyster farming.
So the basket system is called Flip Farm, and
the idea of growing oysters in floating systems in the top of the water column is it's fairly new, but this system in particular is less than 10 years old.
The Flip Farm system is one that just appealed to both of us from an efficiency standpoint. We both are engineers from Georgia Tech, and I'm industrial engineering, so systems, efficiency, all of that stuff has always appealed to me. So when we learned about this system and how they use the design process to iterate and innovate and make something that is, you know, pretty backbreaking work into something a little bit more mechanized and efficient, it really appealed to us.
To get a sense of what this looks like, picture long pipes with rows of rectangle-shaped boxes attached on hinges floating halfway submerged in the water. Flip farming involves driving along the rows with a small boat and methodically flipping the boxes to stimulate oyster growth.
And basically you set up the lines in rows so you can just work down a line. You're never having to, you know, lean over the boat to work for extensive periods of time. And then it also has mechanized ways to flip and return the baskets to the water. So you just drive it up along the boat and flip them.
So the advantage of the floating basket system or any sort of floating aquaculture system for, particularly for oysters in this case, is that it keeps the oyster right there in the top foot of the water column where all the phytoplankton and diatoms and all the stuff that they're eating is. So it constantly stays there, and that's why they grow so fast and they stay so clean and the meat quality is so good, because we're staying right here in this nutrient-rich, fast-moving water versus the wild oyster that's grown on the bank. You know, it's only in the water a few hours a day. It spends half of its life out of the water. And so it grows slower and it grows in a different environment. But genetically, it's the same. That's one of the things that's really fascinating about it.
This method of farming can have huge benefits for the environment.
Basically, we've made an artificial reef, too. We've seen all sorts of marine life already in and out of these things. Little shrimp, fish. The blue crabs love hanging out on. We see blue crabs hanging around the baskets. It provides structure and habitat, as well as cleaning the water. So as conservationists, we see it as a win-win for everyone. It's one of the few farming practices that really leaves its environment better than it found it. Not only do our oysters take off pressures on the wild oysters on the banks, but even while they're in the baskets that you saw, they are providing habitat for juvenile fish, shrimp, and crabs. They're a floating reef. There's genuinely no downside to it. It's an awesome thing.
Laura and Perry aren't your typical farmers, but spending time with them in the water today, I could really feel their knowledge and passion. They've lovingly named this particular site Bull River Ranch.
You know, and it's kind of cool. It's called a ranch.
Yeah, you know, the whole ranch thing, obviously it sounds a little gimmicky, but as we got to talking about, we're on the Bull River, and they're animals, right? So, we're ranchers.
I'll take your word, bro.
There are many, many ways to grow oysters, and there's a whole lot of science involved. But the basics are this. You take fertilized larvae, or juvenile oysters, aka spat, and leave them in nutrient-rich water to grow. And on the mighty Bull River, the water is just about as nutritious as it gets.
Hey, go for it.
Growing up here, I always thought that the water was just muddy, you know, like that's kind of, I think people come from here maybe used to go into a white coral Florida beach or something, you know, it's a little put off by the muddy water here, but one of the aspects of it is that it's not just silt in the water, it's the nutrients. That's rich organic matter, algaes and colonial algaes that are growing there that are the food source for these oysters too. So they are loving it as much as we are.
On this ranch, every day is a new opportunity to learn.
We're still playing around, we're still figuring out what our magic number is in terms of producing, you know, getting the size and the shape of the oyster that we want. Too low, like if we only put, if we put a very thin layer of oysters in the bottom of here, if we put just a handful, you see the wave action and the boats go back, they would just constantly get tossed around and they'll turn into like little golf balls. I mean, they look kind of cool, but they're very hard to shuck and they take a long time to grow because they're just constantly being bounced around and they're not, they're just in survival mode.
Like we mentioned, Bull River Ranch is what's known as a flip farm. And when I came to visit, it was flipping time.
one of the reasons for flipping, so we use a system called Flip Farm, and one of the reasons you have to flip the farm is to desiccate things that grow on both the cages and the oysters. So we want to control barnacle growth, wild spat set, all on the oysters in the cages, but also keep maximum water flow through the cages since that's the oyster's food and nutrition. You can see there's barnacle growth down in there. So as soon as the oysters are old enough to handle it, we flip them for as long as possible. Now that the weather's cooler, it's a little bit more manageable.
It was also harvesting time, at least for some of these guys.
So I'm just notating so we know when we're done with the big ones and transition to the smaller size.
That's when it goes to the sorting machine.
Exactly, so that we kind of know which ones are market ready, which ones need a little bit more time.
What are you looking for, Laura, in your oyster?
Well, you can see how this one's obviously bigger, but it's narrow. We like them when they're a little bit more round. And you can see it looks a little bit fatter here than here. This means the cup, the meat, the shell ratio is a little bit better in this one because that speck shell kind of popped in this.
So you're looking for
For the cup, the deep cup to hold the brine, nice shape that's a little bit wider, and the good wheat to shell ratio. So when you open it, it should be full of fish and of water.
The ideal oysters are big and meaty with a decent sized cup.
Half shell market, it's not going to sit as nicely on a plate or, you know.
Yeah.
When we get, a dozen shucked oysters, we always flip them over and look at the back. I don't know how many people do that, but.
If you're truly appreciating it, that's what you should do.
But it's flat on one side and kind of.
Yeah, the flat part is what you never get to the table. That's what the shucker takes off and.
Right.
Yeah.
Throws away or hopefully holds to side to be recycled.
Yeah, so our goal is to have it be, like a cup that holds the taste of the water with the oyster. The cups always keep the brine inside with the meat.
Like I mentioned before, Laura and Perry are trailblazers when it comes to flip farming in Georgia. Oyster farming with this technique requires a special permit.
Yeah, they call this a subtitle lease.
That's sub, T-I-D-A-L. Subtitle, not like the ones on your television.
And it's called subtitle because the lease never dries out, right? So the farm equipment and everything is attached subtitally to the river bottom versus historic wild harvest leases for oysters are intertidal. You know, you're farming the mud bank out there that dries out twice a day. So that's what makes this different, is that these oysters are always in the water and they're not down in the mud.
Before the framework of how to regulate floating farms existed in Georgia, those leases were not easy to obtain.
And there had to be legislation passed that authorized the DNR to create a framework for how they were going to do floating farms. So we followed that. You know, they did a great job of having a lot of town halls that we were able to participate in. And then, that legislation got passed in 2019. And then DNR made a framework, the Coastal Resources Division. And then they created a lottery process for these three leases. You can see we're in the middle of two more. So those other two, I believe, have just gotten their permits or will be permitted soon. And they can start farming as well.
Without that crucial legislation, we wouldn't be out here today, soaking up the sun and breathing in that sweet, salty air from the Bull River.
This estuary is definitely untouched by industry, and it's almost untouched by man. I mean, this estuary, the Bull River, its tributaries, all the way out to the Wausau Sound, is a well-preserved, and it's a gift to us from the people that back in the 70s took the time to pass the legislation and protect it. And I think we're set to start reaping some of those benefits in a sustainable and non-destructive way. I think that's what's really exciting.
The University of Georgia's Marine Extension and Georgia Sea Grant program lent Laura and Perry a big helping hand in establishing this farm and helping these oysters reach their full potential.
The good scientists out of the Marine Extension, they have been working on, selectively breeding the genetics of these oysters from wild Georgia broodstock that makes them disease resistant and makes them well adapted to their environment.
That grant has laid the groundwork for the whole oyster industry in Georgia.
They literally seeded the industry. So without them, you know, we wouldn't have an industry. So they are critical to growing the industry in Georgia because they provide the seed. And they did get funded and got a little bit of a head start on all the regulation and legislation to get us here. They started in 2015 and have been really developing the genetics and perfecting the right oyster to grow in this environment.
Thoughtful help and outreach from UGA have been a lifeline for keeping this farm afloat, literally.
Just like growers on the land side have a similar extension agent to help to consult with and to provide advice, they've been there for us in that capacity as well. It's been really huge. It was really special for us yesterday. They had some seed left at the end of the year in the nursery, and we bought it from them. And they actually delivered it to us out here by boat, which was, I think, is pretty unique. I don't know, other states have that kind of relationship, but we're certainly lucky to be right here, right next to the laboratory, the Shellfish Lab, out on Skidaway Island. So really neat relationship and really fantastic people.
And we can't forget the special love shown by UGA's nearby Shellfish Research Laboratory.
But we're certainly lucky to be right here, right next to the Shellfish Lab out on Skidaway Island. So really neat relationship and really fantastic people.
Laura and Perry are two Georgia Tech graduates who have set their differences aside and willingly work with the UGA Bulldogs for the sake of these fine oysters. It really warms your heart.
Are y'all okay being Georgia Tech working with the UGA people?
Oh, we love it. Some of the greatest people. They've actually got a couple of Georgia Tech grads there too, so we're super proud of those guys.
The body structure of an oyster itself is fascinating.
And explain the mantle. Why is that important?
The mantle is the outer edge here, that frilly edge, and that's where the oyster is growing from. The mantle is what puts on the shell and produces the oyster shell. So very important part of it. Yeah, that is what secretes the shell, the mantle.
Oyster farmers stock floating baskets with thousands of baby oysters on mesh screens, just waiting for the chance to meet their best friends. That would be crackers and cocktail sauce on your dinner plate.
This basket for our grow has a 10 millimeter hole. We have some with a 5 millimeter hole, some with a 3 millimeter hole, and some that are just in a mesh basket. So again, we have like a gold panning kit that we started off with. It's just a screen. You're just shaking it just like you're mining for gold. These will be our market oysters in a couple months. So we're stocking at their final stocking density for grow out. What you'll see later is we'll go and dump some smaller ones and sort them. Or what you'll see is when we dump ones, it's a very mixed size. Like the ones that were kind of on the outside, were eating and stealing all the food, and kind of the guys that were inside and sheltered out, maybe smaller, kind of the runts of the litter. So looking to split up the fast growers and keep them moving up.
When managing an oyster farm, a big consideration is to not overcrowd the baskets when stocking. Gotta give those guys a little breathing room.
Just like a herd of cattle, it's their efficiency and how they feed and the food source, where they are within that basket. Stocking them enough so that the water can flow through there and that they can get tumbled around and polished and cleaned by the water flowing through here. But also so that they don't become overcrowded or too heavy for the flotation so that it can't be properly dried.
Knowledge like that has been crucial to keeping Tybee Oyster Company running. And networking with other oyster farmers has made one thing clear. People in this industry don't gatekeep information.
For the last 7 or 8 years, we've been going to industry events before we were farmers and talking to farmers. And what's very cool about it is they're all very collaborative. No one is, there's no turf wars, there's no secrets. Like if you ask someone a question, they want to share their knowledge with you because it's not a competitive space. Like we can't grow enough, you know, to meet the demand right now. And it's a very good, very sustainable source of protein. I think it is definitely a future for us that alleviates other stressors on our environment. There's no secret sauce. The people that share all their experiences and information with you, they do it knowing that even if you just copied and pasted their recipe for their oyster, It's not going to turn out the same here. It's going to be different. It's every one of these little, they're like, there's so many similarities to growing grapes and wine. You know, the wine people talk about terroir, how the it tastes like the earth that it comes from. Well, the oyster industry's adapted the term terroir, that, you know, you're tasting the place that it's from.
Despite the fun of having a job on the water, Perry tells me that oyster farming can sometimes be a humbling experience.
If you don't come into this with some humility, Mother Nature and King Neptune will definitely serve you some up. We had tropical storm force winds out here. So you can see straight out to the ocean right there on that heading, which is south, southeast. And that's where the predominant winds were from, unfortunately. So we had a big swell through here. Pulled up some of our anchors, tangled up our lines, damaged some equipment. But we didn't lose many oysters, so that was fortunate. It was just a lot more work putting it all back together.
Farming is always hard work, but any good farmer knows that employing the right technology when necessary will save time and save your back.
Who created this conveyor device? It's pretty fascinating.
Some farmers in New Zealand, they farmed mussels, got into oysters. Much like our wild oyster harvest industry over there, their seafood industry, they saw that it was a young man's backbreaking labor kind of thing, and they had a hard time retaining people that wanted to do that hard work. So you can see there's a lot of ergonomics here, like everything's at the right height, it's you know, it's efficient, it's mechanized. And one of their selling points is they found they could really diversify their workforce, men and women and older people, younger people, all could come out and do this labor. Now that it was kind of broken up into manageable chunks.
Oyster farming is a delicate and temperamental art form, often compared to winemaking. Both winemakers and oyster farmers take special care with growing conditions and time of harvest to make sure the result is the highest quality.
What we're waiting on is this color, the meat to fill out in the oyster. So this is still a juvenile oyster that's not quite ready for market yet. Nice shell size. But what's going to happen over the next couple months is that meat's going to really pump up and fill out the shell.
It's time to sample one of these oysters and taste the Georgia River that birthed it. These are what they call salt bombs.
So take this one now, and we'll dump some of the salt water out. You can enjoy the flavor a little more, and you'll taste the sweetness of the adductor muscle and kind of the creaminess of the body.
Oh yeah.
Yeah?
And the aftertaste is great.
Sweet.
Yeah, it's a sweet aftertaste.
It's all there, like all the flavors are there.
Yeah. You get the salt at first and then the sweet comes.
The future is bright for oyster farming in Georgia. Visiting Laura and Perry with the Tybee Oyster Company on the Bull River today has made that fact abundantly clear.
But being able to take that wild Georgia oyster and turn it into something that could be served at a fancy restaurant as a half-shell oyster is an artisan thing. It's more than just hard work and blood, sweat, and tears and getting muddy, but it's also, there's some art and craft to it that we're really proud of too.
For more stories like this one, you can watch A Fork in the Road on GPB TV or anytime on the gpb.org website. That's where you'll also be able to listen to and subscribe to this podcast or download it on your favorite podcast platform. I'm David Zelsky. Thanks for listening to A Fork in the Road.